Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Debbie Guy-Giesch with the Pettawitz Group, and welcome to WRMR, Revenue Marketer Radio. Every Thursday at 2 o'clock, we meet to talk to a real revenue marketer and learn tips and tricks on how to make that transition from traditional marketing to revenue marketing. And it's more than just about listening. This is an interactive show, so please feel free to call in or chat, and we're happy to include you in the dialogue. Now, before I introduce our guest, I do want to take a moment just to define the term revenue marketer. And it seems as though we have guests who are tuning in from all over the world, and a lot of times they just haven't heard that term. So we get a lot of questions about what is a revenue marketer. And really, a revenue marketer is a very specific type of marketer. Revenue marketing does not involve just another check in your to-do box. A revenue marketer is a person on the marketing team who has revenue or revenue-related accountability through the kinds of campaigns, communications, and digital interactions that they set up. They're responsible for the top of the sales funnel and interacting with and nurturing leads until they are sales ready. And they all, every one of them, use some type of marketing automation platform integrated with CRM to power their revenue marketing practice and to get revenue results. So every week on this radio show, we explore all facets of revenue marketing, everything from metrics, what kind of people, what kind of skills do they need to have, what does compensation need to look like, what should the organizational structure be, what are the key processes you might need to change, how do you align sales and marketing, what do I do with content and creative, and then what are those demand generation strategies and tactics that you need to be using every day? And every revenue marketer on this show has sat in your seat. I don't have experts come on the show so they can tell you what they think you should do. Everybody who's on our show has actually sat in your seat. They've bought a platform. They've implemented and built demand generation practices, and they've created a revenue impact for their organizations. And they're on the show just to share their journey with you and also to share their gotchas so that as you begin your journey toward revenue marketing, it'll be a lot faster, and it'll also be a lot smoother. Now, I want to introduce our guest today. I'm so very, very pleased. I think he is our first Canadian on the show for this season. I think we had a couple of Canadians last season. But let me introduce Jeffrey Yee of Dun & Bradstreet. He lives in Toronto, Canada, and he's been a B2B marketer for 7 years. And let me emphasize B2B because a lot of people on the show are a little confused. Are you talking about B2C? Are you talking about B2B? The majority of what we do is focused in the B2B. Now, Jeff has worked for several leading companies in both Canada and the U.S. where he's implemented and executed programs driven by marketing automation. And for him to have done that a couple of times really puts him into an elite category of revenue marketer. He currently works for Dun & Bradstreet as a demand generation thought leader for the commercial customer sales channel in the U.S. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, Debbie. Thanks for having me on.
It is such a pleasure to have you. You know, with every guest, we do a pre-interview, and we just kind of sit down, and I really want to understand kind of what they're passionate about and what they'd like to talk about. I don't have a schedule of things that I ask people to talk about. I feel like the stories are more relevant if our speaker's passionate about it. And so when I sat down and talked to Jeff, he had a long title, but let me tell you what he wants to talk about. Getting quick wins with marketing automation when you are challenged against the odds, which I think is a great title. So, Jeff, can you explain to us what was this challenge that you were faced with?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for those folks that may not be that familiar with DMB, maybe we'll just start there give everyone a little bit of context. DMB is an information services company. We provide insight that our customers need to make confident decisions. So we're talking anything from trying to figure out how to grow their business or make decisions around managing supply chain risk or credit risk management. large Fortune 1000 company, and as a result, you can imagine a very large sales team of hundreds of sales reps in this channel alone. So with that said, the marketing challenge against all odds is trying to implement marketing automation in this large channel and deliver results in a very compressed time frame. So within literally the span of a quarter, and there are very high expectations around what will be delivered, the improvement that this dedicated marketing support would make, and to compound matters, we're not talking about a large marketing team that has been tasked with implementing this. We're talking about a very small, fledgling demand generation team that actually started with just two people.
That's amazing. And you guys were able to get a result in one quarter.
That's right.
That's simply amazing.
Yeah, so just to, you know, when we talk about results that we've been seeing, Debbie, it's been very, very encouraging. We look primarily at new business pipeline creation and the actual dollar value of that new business pipeline. And we are seeing across the board on all of our new business pipeline metrics a very nice looking lift, a trend that's really encouraging.
That's awesome. And now, how long have you guys been engaged in with marketing automation?
We've been using marketing automation for, I would say, almost 8 months now. So
wow.
After going live, yeah, we went live in February. So here we are in September.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I know that you were able to share privately with me your pipeline numbers, and they are, I will tell you, quite impressive. But let me rewind a bit. How did you identify or know that marketing automation was a solution? Let's go back 8 months and tell me what was going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the key factors was, as they were kind of building out this sales team and decided that they wanted marketing support, I think when they had done that, at the end of the day, you know, what type of resourcing would this marketing support have? That was a key driver. So, you know, being faced with limited resources, and I know that a lot of your listenership certainly would have felt being in that position over the past couple of years. So trying to do more with less. And, with that said, as a marketer, I think it's our responsibility to look and exercise that diligence to determine the type of solutions that you are selling, as well as determine the key steps required in terms of making a successful sale and understand where you're encountering the most challenges selling today. So these are all things that we thought about before moving forward with marketing automation. And in our industry, Debbie, we are constantly challenged with trying to explain the value of high-quality data, right? That's one of the key pieces of D&B's value proposition. And this is something that's obviously intangible, right? So there's a lot of conceptual education that has to occur with the prospect. So how do we teach our prospects and educate them? And as well in our industry, we sell in annual commitments. So understanding that if you are up against a competitor, you need a way to stay in touch with your prospect over time until that prospect's contract is up for expiration. So those are all factors that really pointed us in the direction of marketing automation.
So I think that a lot of times we find these kinds of things true whenever we find a marketing organization who is just now beginning to take a look at buying a marketing automation platform. Typically, we hear things like limited resources. You know, we want to do more with less. We certainly hear challenges in selling. That's typically the top of the list. We hear a lot around if your solution is kind of hard to understand, the challenge of how do you educate better, faster, as you're in the nurturing and then as you're in selling. And then, of course, it's always about the competition. And I will say this. I think that marketing automation and demand generation as a practice, I would say that, you know, 12 months ago, it was not there were a lot of people who compete with one another who don't use it. And now what we're finding is it is a competitive, strategic advantage to have marketing automation, and it truly is one of those competitive weapons that help. We also see, when you think about companies that are looking at buying marketing automation, one of the other big factors that we see is a huge need for marketing to show some type of ROI, return on investment. Typically, a lot of times that's the number one reason why marketing automation systems are bought, especially in companies where marketing is doing a good job in working with sales and handing over those leads. But I can imagine where you were 8 months ago or probably 10 or 11 months ago, and I can imagine that these challenges that you had were certainly ones that marketing automation, and clearly it has, can help you overcome. Given that you bought marketing automation 8 months ago, it helps you address these issues that you had. What was the key to gaining alignments that you needed to move forward? Because, you know, it's not just about somebody in marketing deciding they're going to buy marketing automation. It's a little bigger than that.
That's right. That's right. Well, while you're absolutely right, Debbie, you know, the marketers may determine that, hey, you know, we've done that due diligence, we understand our business, we think marketing automation can help, but, you know, absolutely right. Nothing is going to truly happen until you have that alignment from someone, in my opinion, in the executive level suite. So important for the marketers listening out there to find that executive level sponsor, win that sponsor over so that he or she understands that how your programs driven through marketing automation will become part, an integral part of their plan. So important. And once that happens, a lot of things internally are going to change. Your sponsor will be able to provide both the compliance that you need in terms of the sales reps that will be running with these programs, and as well help to give you the airtime to promote this, because marketing automation, you know, for those that have gone through it, understand that it really is a cultural change in the way marketing is delivering support. And it takes a little bit of getting used to, a little bit of a leap of faith, but with that executive level sponsor, it can certainly help to position it the right way and really help to ingrain automation and using automated programs as part of their sales reps, you know, prospecting DNA.
I love that prospecting DNA, and you are so correct. A lot of times when people engage in buying marketing automation, they think, well, you buy the tool, you turn it on, how hard is this, right? But for many companies, there needs to be a cultural shift. How marketing will be marketing and the impact they make on revenue changes radically. Further, how sales and how they now use online behavior to make better pursuit decisions also changes dramatically. And I also love your comments around having an executive level sponsor. And I also want to add just a few points to that. When I go in and I look at companies, one of the very first things I look for is who's the executive champion. And if I don't find one, I can tell you exactly what state their demand generation practice is in. I can tell you it's not going to be the top of the game. I can tell you there's going to be a lot of frustrations, and I can tell you that sales and marketing is probably not aligned. On the other hand, when I go into companies and I see that executive sponsorship, that active executive sponsorship, and that is best characterized by a dashboard that goes to the senior management team in real time that shows the contribution that marketing is making to revenue. When that becomes a part of the day-in and day-out dashboard that the senior management team uses to determine the health of the company, just like a sales pipeline is, then you know you've got the right level of executive sponsorship. So, Jeff, I couldn't agree more that executive level sponsorship is absolutely, absolutely critical. Can you give us some stories or maybe a little bit more information around how you were able to get sales on board?
Yeah, Absolutely. So when you think about driving adoption, right, once you have your first program developed, right, let's say it's a, you know, for the sake of argument, the lead nurture program, like we had done at D&B, we really, took the mandate to make things as easy as possible to get our sales team started, right? And when you think about quick wins, when you're under pressure, the last thing you want is a room full of salespeople that are skeptics and not willing to engage with these programs because of the perceived amount of work required. So, one approach that we found helpful is to literally make it something that within the CRM, the same selling CRM that your reps are using day in, day out, make the nurture opt-in process put in directly into that system. You know, don't take them out of their environment that they are already used to. So giving them access in a very easy way that they are already familiar with is important. And, you know, Debbie, we've even gone so far as to be this blunt, but literally playing back a list of contacts that a specific rep has in their portfolio and, you know, literally in a spreadsheet format, let them simply put a yes or no to determine which contacts marketing should be talking to through our lead nurture programs, right? And sometimes by really driving adoption in that basic a manner, you get your highest compliance rates. And the other thing I would add too, there's another important piece there, I think, is segmentation. So casting a very wide net. When you're looking at your programs, making them self-service so that the reps can not only opt in which contacts they believe should be in this program, so kind of giving them, putting them in charge of their own destiny, but creating content that is not tied to a hard offer or a specific product. And I think that's a really key piece of this, is when you're looking for your quick win, trying to drive adoption, if there's any chance that you may derail or torpedo existing dialogue that could be going on that the marketing team is not aware of, that could put adoption of your program in jeopardy.
I think you're right about the segmentation, and I do find that driving adoption is incredibly important. So let me make a couple of points on that as well based on what we've seen. Number one, sometimes we go in to work with a customer, and the hardest part about adoption is actually on the marketing team itself. And we typically find that when a team has been very structured around creative and around content, really have not done a whole lot of work around lead generation. Got a good friend of mine who's VP of marketing for a company on the West Coast, and she was actually hired to come in and build and run a demand generation organization. And she told me her biggest challenge was her existing team, in that she had to get them to see that their new job was to be all about demand generation, and so she helped skill them up. She did have to make one change, but she had to first drive adoption and passion around demand generation for her marketing team. Now, I don't think that was ever an issue at D&B. I think you guys got it from the very beginning. But second of all, after that, it's all about sales. I mean, once you've got the marketing team on board and they're passionate about it and they want to drive and make an impact on revenue and they're focused in that direction, it really is about getting buy-in, and not just buy-in, a vested interest. Your sales team should have a vested interest in what you do and vice versa as well. And so getting that sales team on board, and a lot of times for large organizations, what we'll recommend to companies is do something as simple as once you've got your marketing automation system in and set up and you're ready to do a campaign, take one field sales guy and say, you know what, you're special, and we're going to put you in a beta program. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at your territory and we're going to devise and build a series of campaigns just for you to help you drive your revenue, to help you hit your quota. And then you work specifically one-on-one and have those special campaigns, and those campaigns come out under that salesperson's signature as well. I don't know what it is. It's just something about salespeople. They're like four-year-olds. If one person has the toy, you're laughing, Jeff. They all want the toy. So we have actually seen that kind of model to help drive adoption. Again, in larger organizations, it seems to work that way as well. So anything to add to that, Jeff? Because you were laughing.
Yeah, no, you know what? It's certainly one of those marketing universal truths about engaging with your good partners in sales. So I was just more laughing in agreement.
Okay, very, very glad. So one of the major hurdles you did have, and we had talked about that before, was driving adoption, and we've talked about that. Did you have any other major hurdles, and how did you overcome them?
You know what, there is one other thing I would add to that from a hurdle perspective is timing. So we mentioned early on in the program about the challenge that we were faced with, and part of that challenge was timing. So, you know, how do you go from 0 to 60 in a very short period of time? And this is where I'll actually, recommend that when you're looking to implement marketing automation, and you may or may not have a lot of familiarity with the system, with your chosen system. In my example, I had done this before, so I kind of knew what I was getting into. And even with that said, you know, opted to identify a very strong professional services partner that had a lot of experience helping companies like D&B implement in short periods of time. And I think that is a very important step in your project plan in order to hit your timing. It may be worth the investment, and that's exactly what we did at D&B. We found the right partner, and they were able to deliver, go live with their first program by our target date.
And I think that's a really good comment. And again, at the Pedowitz Group, we've helped implement over 500 companies. And the companies run the gamut. It could be someone where, you know, they buy the solution, they do minimal interaction and training, and, you know, they're up and they're running. But certainly for situations like D&B, where there was a business need to get up and running very, very, very quickly, having somebody come in to work with you who's been there and done that can really, number one, help collapse the time to get that first campaign out the door, and also make sure that you've got a very highly effective campaign that is getting out the door, that will get you the conversions, that will get you the MQLs, and that will get you the opportunities. And there are many fine companies, one of which I know quite well, who could actually help people go out and do that. But you guys did have a very, very fast timeline, and it was pretty fascinating what you were able to do within that period of time. Now, Jeff, can you provide a little more detail into the program that you've developed and kind of how you got there?
Yeah. I mentioned, lead nurturing is where we started with marketing automation at D&B. I think one thing that's interesting, and this may be a little more philosophical, but from a marketing perspective, when you think about marketing automation, I think there's a really big piece that's important around the ideation process. Let me explain what I mean by that. So when you're trying to figure out what your first program should look like, I think, you know, by and large, companies that look and consider marketing automation tend to already be doing a lot of things successfully, right? If you've made it that far that you're ready to make this next leap in marketing investment, then the odds are there's a lot of things that are working well at your company. And I think when you look to identify your quick win, I think that a big piece of it is discovering, how you are successfully closing new business. What does that process look like when you break it down into its most basic elements? And that's what you have to focus on making more of happen, right? And how do you get there? How do you do that identification process? Well, at D&B, you know, it looked like this: sitting down with our sales reps in focus groups, right? Listening in on actual live sales calls, analyzing existing emails that they were using that secured appointments, identifying the specific selling steps that turn that lead into an opportunity, right? So maybe, you know, for some software companies out there, maybe the flashpoint when that occurs is the free trial. Or maybe for other companies, it's that complimentary analysis offer. So being able to identify what is that one or two specific, almost evergreen offer that seems to really convert the interest, and then focusing your automation around that, I think is a nice rule of thumb to follow. And you also need to start looking at the types of solutions you are selling as well to determine, you know, the key factors that are really required to make a successful sale, to have that quick win, and avoid making drastic changes, right? And this is something, Debbie, I'm not sure if you've seen this before, but when companies, you know, bring in marketing automation for the first time, so this is maybe a small tangent, but, you know, do they ever fall into the trap of completely reworking how they sell? Because I think that there's a potential to change almost too much, too quickly, and, potentially get derail your what is working well in the company. Does that make sense, Debbie? Hello, Debbie? I'm not sure if anyone is there on the call. We may have encountered some technical difficulties. I heard a few noises there. Apologies if folks are online listening in right now.
Looks like we might have had a technical difficulty.
Yep, no problem there.
I totally agree with that. If you could expand on that a little bit, and
yeah,
we'll see if Debbie can dial back in.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, you know, I was making the point of when you do look for that quick win with marketing automation, you know, not trying to change that selling process too much, because the odds are there's a lot of things that are working, and if you are looking for that quick win, it's usually, in my experience, just making a small change, allowing marketing to step in and perhaps offer more qualification to leads, but let the follow-up occur how it does to date.
And, you know, I agree. I'm back. Can everyone hear me, Jeff?
Yes, absolutely, Debbie.
Sorry about that. Welcome to the world of Internet radio. So, but I think that was a great follow-up question and a really great point, because what will happen from a marketer standpoint, you'll get this marketing automation tool, and you'll have it 2, 3, 4 months, and your world will shift 180 degrees, and you'll think about all these changes that you'd need to make. A lot of those changes need to go downstream into the sales process. But doing that slowly and taking a thoughtful approach to that, as Jeff has outlined, is absolutely critical, because the last thing sales wants to hear is marketing telling them how they need to do anything that is remotely related to selling. So I can't agree with you more that you need to have some quick wins, and you really need to avoid those drastic changes. But I want to come back to something you had told me about in your process, Jeff, and that was this whole notion of focus groups. What did sales think when you said, we want to sit down with you and have a focus group?
They were actually very receptive, and this is, I know that there's been a lot of psychological evidence that has found this. You know, when you take one, two, or five workers aside, right, and really invite them to engage in a process, they almost, by virtue of being identified as someone requested for feedback, in my experience, are always very receptive. and almost love the attention and the ability to speak their minds. People like that in general. So never have gotten any pushback there, Debbie.
I agree. And one of the pieces of advice that we always give marketers who are beginning to build their revenue marketing practice, who are looking at bringing in marketing automation, I wrote a white paper earlier this year called The Laser Approach, and it really stands for learning, aligning, selection, L-A-S-E-R, engineering, and then getting a result. And all the way up in learning and aligning, it's about getting sales on board with marketing before you even bring in the marketing automation system, or certainly as part of that process. Now, 2 years ago, when we walk into a company, we tell marketers, okay, we're going to have this discovery session with you, and we need to have sales in here with us. They look at us like we had two heads. But now it is much more commonly understood the value of sales because, number one, you're producing a marketing qualified lead at the end of the day that has to go over to sales, and they need to have a vested interest in that process all the way from the beginning. That way, they'll have a vested interest in following their service level agreement and how to treat that lead, and then you together can work on improving that pipeline. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, when it comes to aligning sales and marketing, including them in focus groups, it has worked 100% of the time, you know, when we have actually engaged with that, okay? So, Jeff, what were some other details in your program that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah. Just getting back to the actual program itself. So we were talking about the process, that ideation process that I mentioned, is really, really key to making sure that your first program, when it comes out the door, is applicable to both what you have to sell at your company as well as how your reps sell today. So just continuing on that thought, at D&B, we literally had the perfect storm for a lead nurture program driven through automation. I mentioned, our products being sold in annual commitments, so needing to stay in touch with prospects over time because they were likely in commitments of their own with their competitors. And knowing that we had to have a deep relationship that was educational in nature in order for our prospects to truly understand the value that we can bring to them. And internally, this is something that's eccentric to our situation, is that we have a large body of what I will call very powerful content, high-value content. Part of the challenge was that prospects either didn't know about services that we offered in their category, or we're not currently looking for a solution. So, you put all these things together, right? I mentioned the perfect storm. This is a fantastic opportunity to leverage lead nurture as an approach, as a program approach, to start sharing this great content with our prospects. And we did so in a very, very personalized way. So, emails coming out from the salesperson made to look as if they had taken the time to write them. And from a marketer standpoint, finishing touch on a great nurture program, in my opinion, is for the marketers to really put themselves in the salesperson's shoe. So you've gone through your focus groups and all of your good learnings about how your best sales reps sell. Well, now that you've seen that, marketers can come in with their very educational and structured focus. And if you ask yourself the question, well, what if I was the account manager? What if I was that new customer acquisition sales representative? How would I write that email? How would I position this white paper to move us towards sales dialogue that was more conducive to winning an appointment, right? And I think therein lies the answer for literally the copy that should be part of one of the email touches in your lead nurture program.
Jeff, how did you get marketing to have that kind of focus?
Well, I think that that's something that you have to develop through experimentation, and it takes time. Running with marketing automation, but ensuring that you intimately understand your business down to the level of understanding how your reps sell is really the key thing. And that's, you know, exactly the seat that marketing holds and is really poised to do. So, you know, I think it's a really huge opportunity for all of the marketers out there that are thinking about lead nurturing programs to challenge themselves to combine those two pieces of knowledge, how their business operates and how their best reps sell.
So this is not your first marketing automation deployment, was it, at D&B? Did you have a deployment prior to? Did you have a background specifically in this?
Yes.
Okay.
We had run marketing automation with the Canadian piece of Dun & Bradstreet.
Okay.
And,
okay.
You know, had you're right. So, you know, going through that cycle once certainly has helped to inform our approach here.
Right.
In the
I'm sure it was extraordinarily helpful having that experience. Again, especially given the tight timelines that you guys had.
That's right.
So I'm fascinated by this program. I'm fascinated by this perfect storm. And I always like to tell marketers, you know, when you think about the kinds of campaigns that you can run that will create the biggest impact, i.e. biggest impact on revenue, you really do want to take a look at a perfect storm scenario. What's just sitting right there in front of you that you could point marketing automation at and it just make a huge difference. But I also want to go back and talk about this ideation philosophy that you have, because I also have a very strong ideation philosophy. And yet you never hear anybody talk about that. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you guys do that at D&B and what it means for you?
Absolutely. A piece of that ideation is I think it really needs to be put into the charter and vision of your marketing team. All of the companies that think about marketing automation likely have a team. It could be a small team. But having some sort of charter that identifies how you operate as a team with tools like marketing automation is really important. So, you know, things, when you think about your mode of operating, you know, you should want to look for words like sustainable demand generation, entrepreneurial, right? So these are ways that you should put yourself into from a frame of mind perspective when you think about everything that you do around marketing automation, whether it's writing copy for your programs, identifying flows, you know, determining where to go next with your marketing support, you know, by having those types of guiding principles almost, if you will, is a really good way to ensure that, you know, your moves in your ideation process you know, point you in the right direction to take advantage of, you know, tools like marketing automation.
Completely agree. And again, if you don't take the time to do that up front, marketing continues to be the dumping ground. Everything you can think of is going to be dumped on marketing. So I remember a few years ago, I was working with a company up in Boston, actually. It was a global supply chain company. And we came up with a set of guiding principles. I mean, they were brand new to marketing automation and to demand generation. And so we started working on her guiding principles. I said, you need to have, you know, somewhere between, you know, 5 to 7 guiding principles. It doesn't need to be a tomb, right? I said, but one of your guiding principles is that you're no longer going to be responsible for trade shows. Well, that just took her breath away. I'm like, nope, somebody else needs to go do trade shows, because you do 20, 30 trade shows a year, and there's no way you're going to have time to be a demand generation marketer if that's part of your bailiwick. And I said, another thing that has to be, all of your activities have to have revenue associated with them. If somebody comes and wants you to do something, and if there's not a revenue associated with it, you know, then your team can't do that. And what was important about that was, number one, she began to think through what it really meant to take on this responsibility for demand generation marketing. Number two, how different it was. And number three, she then crafted a set of guiding principles that she could take to her peers and to the senior management team and said, you've asked us to do this, So here are the guiding principles. And it was extraordinarily well received. So I always love, Jeff, thinking about guiding principles when someone is setting up their demand generation practice. I think that's really, really important. I want to come back to something that you said, and I want to tell you how fortunate you are. And that was, you said you had some very powerful content. And of course, content is an ever-ending struggle for a lot of demand generation marketers. It's just, it's hard to come by. You know, they don't have a lot of it. But maybe you could share with us, what was the impact of content in the program that you put together?
Right. Content is, this is your lifeblood. If you don't have, you know, something valuable and relevant to share with your prospects, in my opinion, Debbie, you're better off not communicating at all. That's how important I believe content is. So, you know, the challenge, of course, is trying to identify, you know, well, where can I get this content? It's, you know, not all marketers are fortunate, you know, to be in a position where you have, you know, white papers that are up to date and current on the shelf, you know, just waiting for you to load into a lead nurture program, for instance. So a lot of it really has to be around being creative. So, I mean, you, of course, first of all, want to, you know, do the rounds, talk to your folks in product management, talk to your other colleagues in marketing, brand marketing, to determine what is out there, what is relevant, but most importantly, develop partnerships so that go forward. Everyone else that would be considered a thought leader or a subject matter expert in a particular area of what your company sells, they should be very much aligned to helping you identify you know, content that would be relevant to share with prospects. And you know, even go so far as to suggest, we've done some pretty interesting things, Debbie, with even third-party links. So it doesn't always have to be, you know, a full-blown webinar recording or white paper. There could be a really, really handy or really relevant third-party informational website that, you know, if you position as something that, you know, a professional that you sell to would find relevant and interesting, there can be a lot of value in that touch point itself.
I think that's a great summary of some of the things that people need to think about when they're thinking about content in their demand generation programs. And I will say that we hear this often, but a lot of times we'll go into a company and we'll take a look at all the content that they have, and quite often they do have quite a bit of content. And what we like to do is to chunk it down, because as Jeff said, you want to make that touch point relevant and of value. So you are educating, but you should do it in the smallest way possible, so there's a single interaction that creates value for your prospects and yet invites them to demonstrate a behavior which you can then further read of their level of interest or their level of not interest. So content is a little bit like fishing. You know, you're throwing your line out there and you're seeing if you get some nibbles, right? And every once in a while you'll get somebody and it'll be a great big fish. But I think that content, and my advice to marketers who are listening, is just do a content inventory. Just make a list of every piece of content that you have. And then if you're doing lead nurturing campaigns, see if you can't parse out that content. See if you can't, like, take a white paper that's maybe 15 pages and maybe parse it out into three sections. And there are very, very easy ways to do that. And then finally, like you said, Jeff, the whole idea of, you know, having content partnerships or having third-party content, it's about creating value and seeing how people are responding to something. So it doesn't always have to be your content, okay? I love to ask this question. So what was the aha moment that you knew what you had developed was going to work? When was that magic moment?
Oh, that's, you know, something that I look back on fondly as a marketer. I think we always go through this phase where It's you know, very cyclical. We spend all of this time and money up front investing, in this case, in a brand new system. We spend time putting together a program that we believe will deliver the best result possible. And, you know, as we go through that process, it actually builds quite a bit of suspense. And I'll have to say, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you go through that cycle, Debbie. I'm certainly always a little bit nervous just before, you know, that actual formal launch. So, you know, hold your breath, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yeah.
We're about to, you know, turn the feeder on. And, you know, in our case here at D&B, you know, there were a couple of hours, you know, after we had gone live that it was, you know, we were just really, you know, wondering, gee, is anything happening? It just feels quiet, you know, but within a short period of time, we started to actually get forwards from our sales reps, you know, sharing actual verbatims of customer responses, you know, great responses based on the content that we were sending out under their name, you know, and in some cases, even asking for appointments. And that was a big sigh of relief, right? just having, you know, those emails, and, you know, we printed them, all of them out, and we, you know, put them in a binder, right? And just going through that, I'm not sure what other marketers do. I'm sure we all have our own little rituals there, but that is kind of that aha moment when you really have vetted and confirmed that all of the research you have done actually made sense to the prospect.
And I love that story, and you told me you were going to share it, and it is the most exciting thing that can happen to a marketer is when sales comes running back saying, see, look, oh, my gosh, this is just awesome and amazing. And sharing those vignettes early. So if you work in an organization that has a four-day sales cycle, that's one thing. But if you work in an organization where you have sales cycles that are months long or even years long, being able to share these vignettes and these moments of truth, these aha moments across the organization can be very, very powerful. My last company, when I actually bought marketing automation system and used it, that's exactly what we did. We sold really big deals to really big companies, and they were very long sales cycles. And so for us to use marketing automation to get a closed deal wasn't going to happen overnight. And we actually did close our first million-dollar piece of business actually within 6 months. But in the meantime, I captured these vignettes of how sales was responding and just how delighted they were to everything. So I think that's a great story. So clearly, Jeff, this is the second time you've worked with the marketing automation and building a demand generation practice. Clearly, you are an experienced revenue marketer. Where do you think you'll go from here?
Well, you know, when I think about what we've done so far is really build on our quick wins. So, you know, marketers at this stage, you've already proven what you can do with your marketing automation system and your programs. You know, but, you know, for us, it may look like tighter content strategy. So, you know, we just hastily put together some relevant content that we knew was going to work and built out nurture programs with a few touch points. But now we want to keep that momentum going. We really need to focus on getting a flow, getting into a rhythm, you know, so moving from ideation into, you know, very efficient and powerful execution is important to really capitalize on the momentum, especially when you're driving out nurture programs. You want to stay in touch with your prospects, continue to build deeper relationships, and, you know, eventually start mapping your content to those buy stages that you know each and every one of your prospects goes through. You know, things that we're thinking about as well is how do we start leveraging more advanced pieces such as hypersites and forms, and using those tools as ways to further qualify our prospects.
I think those are really great next steps for you. I think that the whole notion of tighter content strategy and really mapping that content to buy stages is incredibly important. And typically what we see is we don't see a lot of clients doing that in the first blush of their implementation. It's typically more like a phase two or a phase three because they know some things are absolutely going to work. But we at the Pedowitz Group, Serious Decisions, I mean, a lot of people talk about the value of mapping out your customer's buying process, not how you want to sell to them, but how they want to buy. And for the revenue marketer, this is incredibly important because you have to think about that buying process. And then as Jeff was describing, line up content to where they are. So, for example, if I'm looking at case studies or if I'm looking at a white paper on something, you know what I'm doing at that point? I'm just researching the solution. I'm not researching D&B. I'm researching the solution. But if the next time I come to the D&B website, I go to a whoever wants to read a data sheet, right, with all the, you know, just all the details around the specific programs, that content's telling me this person is deep into their buying cycle and they're interested in D&B, not somebody else. So really thinking through that content and what that content tells you, especially when you have a marketing automation system from a lead scoring, is incredibly important. So, Jeff, I think that'll be a great next step for you guys to take. And then further, the next level of sophistication for you guys is really around integration of hypersites and forms. And hypersites or microsites allow you to do very segmented, very customized, knock your socks off kind of marketing, really sophisticated, easy to do in a lot of marketing automation systems that can really give you a big, big jump in conversions. And then the last part you said was all about forms. And we find that forms can be an ongoing discussion within many companies. But once you begin demand generation, once you begin revenue marketing, your whole notion of what a form is changes dramatically. I recently published a glossary of terms for marketing automation. It was actually part of a course that I wrote for the Online Marketing Institute for a demand generation certification. And I've got two definitions of forms, the form definition that everybody thinks it is, and then the form definition in the marketing automation world, because there are so many things that you can do with a form, so many processing steps that you could take. You could do progressive forms. It just becomes a completely different animal. So I think those will be two great areas for you guys to focus on next, Jeff. Well, we have a few minutes, so I got to ask my last question. So think hard about this one, Jeff. What is the one, two, or three pieces of advice you would give to a marketer who's having a similar challenge?
Start small. Start small.
Okay.
Stay focused. I mean, this is something that I think is, again, you know, thinking about gotchas, a very easy trap to fall into, you know, when you've just been given the keys to a shiny new automobile and your, tendency will be to want to master and learn every single feature and try everything it can do. And that can be dangerous when you're looking for your quick win. You know, the worst thing you can do is to overcommit yourself to delivering too much too soon. So I think you need to be realistic and understand that if you just take one specific action that is being done manually today in your organization or in your sales process or that the salespeople are doing, and you automate that one thing, that can be a huge win in and of itself, right? But when you do scale quickly so that you can reap the benefits of economies of scale. So start small, look for that one or two things you know will make the most impact to automate it, and try to get that across the organization as quickly as possible once you know it's working.
I think that's great advice, especially coming from a revenue marketer who has done this twice now. And I bet there's probably less than 100 marketers in the U.S. who have done this at least twice. So, Jeff, we are so pleased that you were able to be with us today and to share with us all of your experiences. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Debbie. Thanks for having me.
And next week we're going to have Eric Webb from RSM McGladrey. That is the third largest accounting firm in the U.S. They have an amazing story that they're going to tell around how they implemented marketing automation and drove revenue through a distributed network around the globe. The following week, we'll be doing our show pretty much on the road in the entire month of October. We'll be in Chicago for the first week of October. Second week of October, we'll be doing this live from the Marketo Conference. So I hope you all can join us. Thanks again, Jeff. And everyone, have a happy Revenue Marketing Week.